On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
During his first term, President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. Now he's sending signals about a do-over.
Because he believes that the Iranians are master negotiators, and if he can outwit them at the negotiating table, it will be the ultimate testament to his mastery of the art of the deal.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We also hear today from the outgoing U.S. Special Envoy for Global LGBTQ Rights.
Nobody can fill the gap left by the U.S. government.
Plus, rising winter temperatures are changing life in Russia. And in Japan, it sounds like a recipe for disaster.
If you have a high-speed train encounter a 6.0 earthquake, the train could cause enormous damage.
But Japan's transit system has a stellar safety record. That's ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us. Climate change is impacting us in very visible ways. Fire-charred neighborhoods in Los Angeles, just one example right now. But it is also impacting us in invisible ways.
Before we get into the latest climate news, we have a sonic example that you've probably never experienced firsthand. When it gets cold enough, we're talking around negative 60 degrees Fahrenheit, the frigid temperatures actually speed up how fast sound waves move.
It may sound like the wind, but this is just the sound of very cold air in far northern Russia. This eerie phenomenon is likely to happen less frequently as the climate warms. And here's that news we promised. Last month was the hottest January on record. That news is out today from the European Climate Service Copernicus. It's the second record-setting January in a row. People felt the heat even in places that we associate with the most extreme sound wave bending kind of cold, like Russia. Here's reporter Levi Bridges with more.
Last week, there was a serious heat wave in Russia, by which I mean it got above freezing. Russians around the country posted videos online of birds chirping. On Instagram, one guy even posted a video of yellow flowers poking up from the snow. What are you doing out here, guys? He says to the flowers. It's way too early. He sounds concerned. But a woman I talked to in Moscow was into it. She asked to go by her first name, Yana. In Russia, just talking about the weather with an American journalist makes people nervous.
Это очень радует, потому что обычно зимой такие серые пейзажи, а тут прям.
She tells me the sun came out and she and her kids unpacked their spring clothes. But that's Moscow. There are parts of Russia that are experiencing this unusual weather differently. Yuri Zhigusev is a sociologist in far eastern Russia. He lives in Yakutsk, the world's coldest city. Temperatures there can get as low as negative 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Over video chat, Zhigusev opens the door to his balcony.
Вот наш холодильник, расположенный на балконе. Так, здесь вы видите.
No need for a freezer here, he says, showing me bags of frozen meat, creamy butter, and red berries. Zhigusev says everyone here keeps food on the balcony in winter. The 4 months' worth of meat out on the balcony could spoil during a warm spell, he tells me. Not everyone here has a backup freezer in their apartment. The outdoors is their freezer. Rising winter temperatures also make it harder just to stock grocery stores. Remote villages in this part of Russia aren't connected by year-round transport. Instead, truckers drive supplies out to villages on frozen rivers. I saw a video of this on YouTube where two drivers narrowly escaped sinking into a hole in the ice. That's the delirious laughter of survivors.
Из-за позднего наступления зимы эти дороги...
Жигусов, the sociologist, says rural communities now risk being cut off. Meanwhile, further south, Russia's Lake Baikal near Mongolia completely freezes over each year. It's huge. People live on islands in this lake. But this winter, a resident named Olga Perestaronina filmed a completely ice-free lake.
У нас есть на Байкале эндемик, то есть, да, животное, которое водится только на Байкале, это нерпа.
I was concerned, Perestaronina tells me over the phone, because animals here depend on the winter ice for survival. The temperature did finally drop enough in recent days for Baikal to freeze, but ice roads that cross the lake to distant villages still aren't open. Nadezhda Nikolaeva grew up on this lake. She told me she's never seen the ice road to her island closed this late in the winter.
Также мусор накапливает. Вот я сейчас вот на турбазе нахожусь, у них прям уже видно, что огромное количество накопленного мусора.
Trash is piling up in town, and there's no trucks to take it off the island, she says. But she reassures herself that fluctuations in the weather are normal. Russia has incentives not to fear climate change. Warmer weather is already starting to open up farmland and create shipping routes in the Arctic, giving Russia new economic opportunities. But Alexander Fyodorov, a climate scientist in Russia, says not everyone will benefit.
Конечно, есть такая версия. Кому-то хорошо, наверное, да?
You gotta remember, Fyodorov says, more than half of Russia rests on permafrost, frozen ground. A warming climate won't help anyone living there. Some buildings up north are already cracking and even breaking apart when the permafrost below thaws in summer. Yana in Moscow sent me a video this week. It's colder now, but the birds are still chirping. She hasn't put her spring shoes away.
Прям многие тоскуют, что в этом году в Москве, в Петербурге не было снега.
It's nice outside, she says, but, you know, lots of Russians actually miss winter. The high today in Moscow is just barely above freezing. Still cold, but not Russia cold. For the world, I'm Levi Bridges.
President Trump has signed more than 50 executive orders since his inauguration, and several of them take aim at the LGBTQ community. That's setting off alarm bells for advocates across the globe. Jessica Stern, for one, is worried. During the Biden administration, Stern served as the U.S. Special Envoy to advance the human rights of LGBTQI+ persons. In her first interview since leaving the State Department in January, Jessica Stern spoke with the world's Bianca Hillier. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Marco.
So before we get into your conversation with Stern, just remind us, what was her role as a diplomat in the Biden White House?
She was tasked with integrating LGBTQ rights into all levels of U.S. foreign policy. So ambassadors and other government agencies would come to her for best policy practices. And she also engaged with governments and activists outside the U.S. to work on dismantling discriminatory laws in their regions.
Right. So an important portfolio. And she was not the first person to serve in this position, right?
That's right. This special envoy role was created during the Obama administration and was filled for 2 years before he left office. President Trump left the role vacant during his first term and is not expected to fill it during his second term either. So when President Biden appointed Stern, it was a big deal because there are very few roles like this around the world. And when I spoke with Stern the other day, she said it's important to put LGBTQ rights into foreign policy, because otherwise that population is often left out completely.
Some people may ask, isn't this a niche issue or a marginal population? But I would argue that the test of the rule of law is not how it benefits the most privileged, but how it benefits the most marginalized. And so when we look at the treatment of LGBTQI+ people, it's like a test of whether the systems are working for everyone.
Hmm. As you do look back at your 4 years in the Biden administration, what are some of those achievements that you're most proud of?
I think I would start by just acknowledging that a big focus of my work was fighting violence against LGBTQI people around the world, whether it's being subjected to domestic violence, mob violence, so-called corrective rape, so-called conversion therapy practices,
even up to murder and homicide. But unfortunately, while crimes against LGBTQI plus people are some of the highest in the world, they're also some of the most overlooked and under-investigated. So a big part of what we did was we focused on ensuring that there was a stronger response by police and that public safety took into account LGBTQI plus people. I can think of one country where a young 19-year-old trans woman was mysteriously found dead. We were able to reach out and to ensure that there was going to be an adequate investigation into her cause of death.
Can you tell me any countries or regions where you did see those engagements spark real change?
In 2023, the government of Uganda signed the Anti-Homosexuality Act into law. It's widely considered to be one of the most far-reaching, extreme, and anti-LGBTQI laws in the world. So-called serial offenders of homosexuality, so people like my wife and me, could be liable upon conviction for the death penalty. So-called promotion of homosexuality, whatever that means, but probably it means activism, expression, assembly, maybe even pride festivals, could be punished with up to 20 years in prison. And we wouldn't do anything without consulting Ugandan human rights activists and the communities most affected, but they were very clear in what they wanted. They wanted their government to be held accountable, and they wanted this law to be struck down. So while I wish I could say that the law was struck down, in fact, it wasn't, it's still on the books, it hasn't been fully implemented. And while not being fully implemented is not what I would consider to be a success, the fact that LGBTQI plus people aren't being rounded up en masse is partially because governments around the world, including the U.S., made clear that there would be serious reputational and economic consequences if Uganda took such draconian steps.
When I spoke with you near the beginning of your time in the Biden administration, you said that advancing queer rights here in the U.S. would reverberate around the world. In other words, you know, progress here prompts progress elsewhere. Is the same true if the U.S. backtracks on LGBTQ rights as we're seeing done under President Trump?
There's no question that what happens in the U.S. reverberates globally. And unfortunately, we're already seeing consequences of the Trump administration's actions. There is currently a 90-day pause on U.S. foreign assistance, but we don't believe that LGBTQI groups are going to make it through when foreign assistance restarts in whatever form it takes. Because based on some estimates, the U.S. government, in one form or another, supports roughly a third of the budget of the global LGBTQI rights movement per year. I wish that I could tell you that there's some philanthropist out there who can fill that hole, but nobody can fill the gap left by the U.S. government.
When people do call you, what do they say to you? What are they asking you?
I would say if I walk away from my phone for half an hour, I return to a laundry list of messages. Unfortunately, because so many people, primarily at USAID, but also newly at the State Department itself, have been furloughed, have been put on administrative leave, so many people have had their contracts terminated. When these organizations reach out to me, they're doing so in many cases because when they call the U.S. government, there's no one to answer their call.
And who do you expect to pick up this work?
I always have hope. Governments like Colombia, Germany, Japan, South Africa, Chile, and others have really been demonstrating increased leadership on LGBTQI plus rights in recent years. So it's not the same as having a country with the U.S.'s economic and political might at the table, but there certainly are a lot of governments that still care about these issues and will be doing their part.
That's Jessica Stern, the former U.S. Special Envoy to Advance the Human Rights of LGBTQI plus persons, speaking with the world's Bianca Hillier. We reached out to the Trump administration for comment on how its policies could impact LGBTQ people worldwide. We have not heard back. President Trump has signed more than 50 executive orders since his inauguration, and several of them take aim at the LGBTQ community. That's setting off alarm bells for advocates across the globe. Jessica Stern, for one, is worried. During the Biden administration, Stern served as the U.S. Special Envoy to advance the human rights of LGBTQI+ persons. In her first interview since leaving the State Department in January, Jessica Stern spoke with the world's Bianca Hillier. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Marco.
So before we get into your conversation with Stern, just remind us, what was her role as a diplomat in the Biden White House?
She was tasked with integrating LGBTQ rights into all levels of U.S. foreign policy. So ambassadors and other government agencies would come to her for best policy practices. And she also engaged with governments and activists outside the U.S. to work on dismantling discriminatory laws in their regions.
Right. So an important portfolio. And she was not the first person to serve in this position, right?
That's right. This special envoy role was created during the Obama administration and was filled for 2 years before he left office. President Trump left the role vacant during his first term and is not expected to fill it during his second term either. So when President Biden appointed Stern, it was a big deal because there are very few roles like this around the world. And when I spoke with Stern the other day, she said it's important to put LGBTQ rights into foreign policy, because otherwise that population is often left out completely.
Some people may ask, isn't this a niche issue or a marginal population? But I would argue that the test of the rule of law is not how it benefits the most privileged, but how it benefits the most marginalized. And so when we look at the treatment of LGBTQI+ people, it's like a test of whether the systems are working for everyone.
Hmm. As you do look back at your 4 years in the Biden administration, what are some of those achievements that you're most proud of?
I think I would start by just acknowledging that a big focus of my work was fighting violence against LGBTQI people around the world, whether it's being subjected to domestic violence, mob violence, so-called corrective rape, so-called conversion therapy practices, even up to murder and homicide. But unfortunately, while crimes against LGBTQI+ people are some of the highest in the world, they're also some of the most overlooked and under-investigated. So a big part of what we did was we focused on ensuring that there was a stronger response by police and that public safety took into account LGBTQI+ people. I can think of one country where a young 19-year-old trans woman was mysteriously found dead. We were able to reach out and to ensure that there was going to be an adequate investigation into her cause of death.
Can you tell me any countries or regions where you did see those engagements spark real change?
In 2023, the government of Uganda signed the Anti-Homosexuality Act into law. It's widely considered to be one of the most far-reaching, extreme, and anti-LGBTQI laws in the world, so-called serial offenders of homosexuality. So people like my wife and me could be liable upon conviction for the death penalty. So-called promotion of homosexuality, whatever that means, but probably it means activism, expression, assembly, maybe even pride festivals, could be punished with up to 20 years in prison. And we wouldn't do anything without consulting Ugandan human rights activists and the communities most affected, but they were very clear in what they wanted. They wanted their government to be held accountable, and they wanted this law to be struck down. So while I wish I could say that the law was struck down, in fact, it wasn't. It's still on the books. It hasn't been fully implemented. And while not being fully implemented is not what I would consider to be a success, the fact that LGBTQI+ people aren't being rounded up en masse is partially because governments around the world, including the U.S., made clear that there would be serious reputational and economic consequences if Uganda took such draconian steps.
When I spoke with you near the beginning of your time in the Biden administration, you said that advancing queer rights here in the U.S. would reverberate around the world. In other words, you know, progress here prompts progress elsewhere. Is the same true if the U.S. backtracks on LGBTQ rights as we're seeing done under President Trump?
There's no question that what happens in the U.S. reverberates globally. And unfortunately, we're already seeing consequences of the Trump administration's actions. There is currently a 90-day pause on U.S. foreign assistance, but we don't believe that LGBTQI groups are going to make it through when foreign assistance restarts in whatever form it takes. Because based on some estimates, the U.S. government, in one form or another, supports roughly a third of the budget of the global LGBTQI rights movement per year. I wish that I could tell you that there's some philanthropist out there who can fill that hole, but nobody can fill the gap left by the U.S. government.
When people do call you, what do they say to you? What are they asking you?
I would say if I walk away from my phone for half an hour, I return to a laundry list of messages. Unfortunately, because so many people, primarily at USAID, but also newly at the State Department itself, have been furloughed, have been put on administrative leave, so many people have had their contracts terminated. When these organizations reach out to me, they're doing so in many cases because when they call the U.S. government, there's no one to answer their call.
And who do you expect to pick up this work?
I always have hope. Governments like Colombia, Germany, Japan, South Africa, Chile, and others have really been demonstrating increased leadership on LGBTQI plus rights in recent years. So it's not the same as having a country with the U.S.'s economic and political might at the table, but there certainly are a lot of governments that still care about these issues and will be doing their part.
That's Jessica Stern, the former U.S. Special Envoy to Advance the Human Rights of LGBTQI plus persons, speaking with the world's Bianca Hillier. We reached out to the Trump administration for comment on how its policies could impact LGBTQ people worldwide. We have not heard back.
A tidal flat along the coast of the Yellow Sea on the Korean Peninsula used to be full of all kinds of wildlife. Now it's locked behind a 22-mile-long seawall.
It's as tall as a 4-story building, so this colossal man-made object extending as far as the eye can see.
An up-close visit to South Korea's mud mausoleum. That's ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A ceasefire in the eastern city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo took hold this week. That created the opening for people there to get started on the grim task of burying some 2,000 bodies. These were the victims of last week's battles for the city. The Rwanda-backed M23 rebel group took control of Goma last week and then declared the ceasefire on Monday. Arlette Bashizi is a photojournalist based in Goma.
Right now, the life in Goma, the situation has started going back to normal. Some shop and businessmen have started doing their business as it used to be before. So the life is going back to normal slowly in the town of Goma.
How have people there been interacting with you?
For the last days after the town was taken, everyone was afraid because we didn't know what will happen next. But for now, M22 leaders hold a meeting where they ask people to go back to their normal life activities, and also they promise that the schools will even be opened next week.
Yeah, what has the rebel group M23 been doing aside from those kind of announcements since they took control of Goma? I mean, are they visible in the streets?
Yeah, they are very visible in all the streets of Goma. For now, you can't walk, let's say, 2 kilometers in the town without seeing either a pickup with some militaries from the M23 troops. So they are everywhere in the town now, and they are controlling everything.
I mentioned the 2,000 bodies of people killed in the fighting last week. What is happening with that death toll?
For now, they are doing the mourning of all those bodies in collaboration with the Red Cross. They are doing the mourning of different bodies because for now, with the way the bodies are smelling, it's impossible to identify. Even if you lost a member of your family, you can't tell because it has been a time since people died. So they are just doing the burial of all those bodies together for now.
Sounds really grim. On top of that, there was a prison break in Goma last week and reports that women in that prison were raped. Many died after a fire broke out there. What have you heard about that?
Yeah, after the prison break, I can say even now in the town, the criminality is going higher. In some quarter of Goma, people are still hearing gunshots in the night. People are facing some criminality. And other corner, they are reporting being raped. So for now, we are just observing. The activities in town are going back to normal, but in some neighborhood in Goma, the criminality is going higher. It's probably maybe because of that prison break that happened in town. But in many quarter now in Goma, people are having problem with gunshots every night.
And M23, as you said, is telling people to go back to normal. I mean, how realistic is it for things to be normal right now in Goma?
For now in Goma, they are everywhere. They have a very big troops, so I don't think they'll leave soon. So the population in Goma, I don't think people really have a big choice instead of just trying to run their business and be able to feed their families and take care of themselves. Because for now, I don't think they will have many choices.
Tomorrow in Tanzania, Arlette, there's a summit to determine how to find common ground in this crisis and stop the bloodshed. What is your sense there in Goma? How hopeful people are about these talks bringing some change?
In Goma, people, the civilians, I think they have accepted that for now it will be hard for the M23 to leave Goma if there is no negotiation. So everyone now hope and believe that negotiation between leaders can be a solution to this problem. Otherwise, it's hard to think that people are going to fight in the town. You see, just in 2 days where they fight in the town, 2,000 people died, and maybe more than that.
Mm. So with this very large city of Goma as its prize, I'm wondering what M23 is saying about what they're planning to do next. Have you heard anything?
Today at their meeting, they shared the names of the new government of North Kivu province.
North Kivu province, that's where Goma is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they present to the population and they mentioned that people should go back to their normal activities so that they can lead the town. And also they mentioned that they are ready to conquer even if it requires them to reach Kinshasa, which is the capital of the country.
So M23 is talking about the possibility of marching on Kinshasa?
Yes.
Have they said anything about when they're planning to do that?
No, they didn't say anything. They didn't mention when and how they are going to do it, but they've been mentioning it in the speech they gave today at the popular meeting.
That's Arlette Bashizi. She's a photojournalist based in Goma, a major city in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo that's been seized by the Rwandan-backed M23 rebel group.
In sub-Saharan Africa, the Trump administration's decision to freeze foreign aid has one group of people on edge, people who benefit from the HIV assistance program PEPFAR. Last year, the U.S. contributed more than $6.5 billion to PEPFAR. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports on how people in Accra, Ghana are navigating the possible loss of that support.
This yellow two-story apartment building is one of the few homes in Ghana for orphans living with HIV. About 60 children live here at the Motherly Love Orphanage, a vision brought to life by Reverend John Azuma, a man who has lived with the disease for over two decades.
These are my heartbeats. I'm happy to see them happy.
When Reverend Azuma was diagnosed with HIV in the year 2000, he says he felt hopeless because back then HIV meant only one thing, frail skeletal bodies and a death sentence. But in 2003, antiretroviral drugs or ARVs came to Ghana through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, led by then-President George W. Bush.
And since then, ARV has saved thousands of lives, including myself.
PEPFAR is often regarded as the most successful foreign aid program globally. It saved more than 25 million lives over the past two decades, the majority in Africa, where it was meant to help most. Beyond antiretroviral therapy, PEPFAR provides HIV prevention, treats tuberculosis, the top killer among people living with HIV, and prevents mother-to-child transmission. It also offers mental health care, nutrition programs, and support for vulnerable children. So recently, when news broke that President Donald Trump had signed an executive order freezing nearly all U.S. foreign aid, including PEPFAR, Reverend Azuma says his phone began to buzz with calls.
A lot of persons living with HIV are calling, Reverend, what is happening? Reverend, are you sure we are safe? Are we not going to die? I say, let's keep praying. Let's keep praying.
As the calls kept coming in, his concern shifted to the more than 60 children at the orphanage.
Our survivor here at Motherly Love Orphanage Home is by antiretroviral and nothing else.
The aid freeze is part of President Trump's America First policy, which prioritizes domestic issues over foreign commitments. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has recently said that life-saving aid, including medicine, health care, food and shelter, will be exempt temporarily from the aid freeze.
But life savings means different things for different people.
Yvette Raphael is executive director for the NGO Advocacy for Prevention of HIV and AIDS, based in Johannesburg, South Africa.
We are not sure what is being cut off and what is there.
Raphael is not alone in her concerns. Health officials and aid organizations across several African countries are struggling to interpret the scope of these waivers. Days after the exemptions were announced, many PEPFAR-funded facilities in countries like Mauritius and South Africa remain closed, leaving more than 20 million people who rely on the program highly vulnerable, according to the United Nations AIDS program. South Africa has the highest number of people living with HIV in the world.
Our biggest fear right now is if people are not able to get their treatment where they used to, they're unable to get tested for HIV, we are worried that this would again take up the number of new infections.
In Ghana, Dr. Stephen A.C. Addo, head of the country's National AIDS and STI Control Program, says the aid freeze should have been gradual.
The issue is more about the abruptness of this. There ought to be a communication ahead so that people will prepare for it.
A.C. Addo says the current aid situation could reverse years of progress and further weaken Ghana's ability to respond to both current and future epidemics. But some analysts say it is time for Africa to look within and stop waiting for outside help, like Ben Piri, a Malawian Member of Parliament and chairperson for the Southern and Eastern African Parliamentary Caucus on Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights.
This is donor money. It is taxpayers' money. PEPFAR has been there for some time. We needed by now to have gone into a stage where locally we are able to finance our own activities. Now, there is donor fatigue.
Over 20 years ago, African governments pledged to allocate at least 15% of their annual budgets to health care. Yet, many nations have failed to meet this commitment.
Africa is for Africans, and we need to shape the narrative of the sort of Africa we want in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years. It is leadership that we need in Africa.
But many in public health say that while Africa works towards self-reliance, immediate action is needed to prevent a public health disaster. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman, Accra, Ghana.
The National Symphony Orchestra of Syria has given its first public performance of the post-Assad era. The musicians have been laying low since December 8th, when Islamist-led rebels ousted longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad. He and his wife had been strong supporters of the orchestra. The musicians who took to the stage last week at the Damascus Opera House nearly outnumbered the audience. The concert hall was unheated despite the winter cold. One audience member, Yamama Al-Hao, was wearing a thick wool sweater and a white headscarf when she told Agence France-Presse that this is the Syria that she loves. She says, this place is very dear to me. The music, the people have come to listen. That's the best image of Damascus.
Artists and patrons alike have been apprehensive about how the country's new Islamist leaders would view the performing arts. The Syrian National Symphony Orchestra played a program that included Syrian composers and Western standards. Timpani player Bajat Antaki expressed optimism at the concert. The Syrian culture is marked by pluralism, he says. The concert is a way for us to say we are here and we are able to produce art.
An arid, windswept plateau in northern Spain has caught the eye of some unlikely suitors. Big tech companies are investing billions of dollars in the Spanish province of Aragon. The World's Jerry Haddon visited some of the tiny towns in the region to see why high tech has taken such a shine to the area.
When you upload your photos and files to the cloud for storage, this is the sort of place they end up.
I'm standing outside one of three huge Amazon data centers. This one's in a town called Burgo de Ebro. And it's a curious building because it doesn't have any sign on it anywhere that says Amazon. It has no windows, just giant grates, I suppose, for ventilation for the servers inside, because that's what's working here.
Shelves and shelves of thousands of interconnected servers, pulsing and buzzing with data. This in a region better known for, among other things, vultures and tumbleweed. But for big tech, Aragon turns out to be a great fit, and the money is pouring in.
En este último año, a Aragón han venido, se van a anunciar, hemos anunciado ya.
Perhaps no one is happier than the president of Aragon, Carlos Azcón. He held a cheery presser with reporters late last year. He said that recent outside investment in the region had reached $25 billion and that more money was coming. It's up to $40 billion now, the government says, as other companies follow Amazon's lead, including Microsoft, Meta, and Blackstone. But why here, out on these dusty plains? Well, land is cheap, and Azcón's government has been fast-tracking permitting, making it easy to set up shop. But the main draw? Wind. A northeasterly wind known as the Cierzo in Spain. It's whipping along outside the nearby village of La Muela. 30 years ago, this town was dead. Then Spanish energy companies showed up with an offer for the landowners who remained to lease their fallow fields for windmills to make electricity. There are thousands of windmills out here now, towering over this town and others. Unlike Don Quixote, who once mistook a windmill for a monster, most folks here have embraced them. And they've gotten rich. Now tech companies hope to harness the wind, too. These windmills can offer them near constant and clean power. Data centers need tons of energy and to reduce their carbon footprint. So tech companies are scouring the earth in search of where energy's cheapest, greenest, and most abundant. Microsoft declined an interview request about its investments in Aragon, ditto with Blackstone. Meta, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, and Spanish data giant Boxed a Bit never responded. But people who live around here are happy to talk about it. At a tobacco shop across from Town Hall in Burgo de Ebro, vendor Joana Alvarez says in the year since it opened its data center here, Amazon's been making a difference.
Hizo una pequeña contribución con las asociaciones, asociaciones de jubilados.
The company's been making contributions here, she says, to the retirees and homemakers associations. At the adult education center, she says, they paid for all the computers and screens and software. In the nearby village of Calatorao, Ana La Huerta serves lunch at Bar Eladio, the one place in town to eat. Just a few weeks ago, she recalls, some executives from Blackstone came through to inspect the land where the company plans to invest some $7 billion in a server complex.
Me parece buena idea porque en el pueblo se ha quedado muy muerto, que no hay mucha industria.
I think it's great, she says, because this town was on the skids. There's little industry besides the marble quarry. Blackstone's project means people will move to town for work, bringing in some wealth. Even if outside workers come in, she says, they'll still be living and spending here, which is a good thing. If Amazon's presence in Aragon is any indication, the real boom in terms of jobs will be during the data center's construction phase. Once they're up and running, they only need a handful of engineers to maintain them. But they'll be buying all that electricity from the region's windmills and paying taxes. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Aragon, Spain.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In coastal regions worldwide, people have drained swampy areas, sometimes filling them in with soil, and then developed that newly salted land. It's a process known as land reclamation, and it comes with an environmental cost. National Geographic explorer Paul Celepek has seen it up close, right under his boots, on his Out of Eden walk, tracing the path of human migration. He wrote about it in his most recent article from The Walk. The title of that dispatch: Mud Mausoleum.
Well, basically what we're talking here is a big lid of bulldozed earth and concrete that's on top of a sarcophagus of what used to be a big wetlands.
A sarcophagus of what used to be wetlands. You're talking here about Saemon Gum, a tidal flat on the coast of the Yellow Sea in Korea, of course. Describe what this place used to be.
So it's kind of a bay or inlet between two headlands in South Korea on the Yellow Sea, and there are two rivers that spill into it. And way back in the 1980s, there was a government plan to build a giant wall between the two headlands and seal off this giant wetlands to drain it.
So that was back in the 80s, you say. So the ecosystem changed a lot when that happened. What did you see when you arrived there?
Carolyn, it's hard to describe the size of this mega project. I do believe it's the longest seawall in the world. I think it's like 21 miles or 33 kilometers long. It's as tall as a four-story building, sort of this colossal man-made object extending as far as the eye can see, kind of bulging out from this coast into the Yellow Sea. So going there today, you see a lot of dead mud. You see kind of dried out vast flats of what used to be kind of mud flats where there are lots of, you know, life and still machinery still working. Because even though this project was conceived in the 80s, it wasn't really started until the 90s, and it didn't quite kind of wind down until 2010.
And so why was it built? What was the idea?
It's changed over time. It was originally built by the last military dictatorship in South Korea to grow rice. You know, rice was a big commodity back then. There was a scarcity. And so they wanted to convert 400 square kilometers of what used to be a wetland into rice paddies. What they discovered as they started draining it is that commercial rice farming wasn't viable. Mm. Their reason for building it has changed over time, which has added an element of disillusionment to the local people. Now it's supposed to be something else.
What is it supposed to be now?
Well, the list is long. I mean, it's, you know, now they've gone from a rice growing area, it didn't work. Now it's kind of eco-friendly industrial zones, a free trade zone, maybe a cruise ship landing port, tourism. They're kind of like throwing anything at the wall that'll stick.
And so those are all ideas and none of them have come to fruition yet?
You know, I didn't see much beyond the massive $3 billion seawall. In the literature that this organization puts out as a government or agency that's building this thing, there are like sketches, you know, mock-ups of like big centers, ports, whatnot. I didn't see much other than a lot of kind of drying mud.
Are they still building the seawall or is that complete?
No, the seawall is complete. It was completed in 2010, but they're still kind of digging channels for the final drainage. They're building roads. So it looks eerily like an unfinished housing tract development.
Okay.
You know, there are no houses, but they're like platted pieces of square dried mud.
So it still looks a little bit like a construction zone.
A bit, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You spent time with an environmental activist there named Oh Dong-pil. What did he tell you about the impact of this seawall on wildlife in particular?
I joined him out there digging into the mud. He was trying to show me sort of how the mud flat has changed. And as you know, in your intro, Carolyn, you know, these mud flats, they're not very aesthetic. You know, they don't look like much. They look like big surfaces of wet soil, right, that get flooded by the sea. But they are hugely important biologically as nurseries for fish, as sources of food for birds, etc. Every time he was plunging in his shovel into the mud, he said, Paul, when I would do this before the seawall, they would be teeming with clams, with crabs, with worms, other life. And every one of his shovelfuls now was sterile. Mm. So he is like his associates in the area, other environmentalists, they're appalled and saddened that they basically have turned this area into a giant desert. Yeah.
You wrote that there is one small area of mud that is full of life. You saw, I guess, wild pigs, water deer, water snakes, raccoon dogs, and Eurasian beaver. What makes that place special? Why are animals thriving there?
Yeah, well, Mr. O wanted to show me, kind of to peel back time, go in a time machine and say, hey, look how it used to be, right? So he drove me to this corner of the former wetlands. It was kind of paradisical, right? There was kind of waist-high grass. There were channels where water was still pulsing in and out, flushing, you know, seawater was flushing the ecosystem. There were lots of birds, including endangered birds, spoonbills flying overhead. But what was very sobering, despite this kind of beautiful postcard picture, is that when he told me, standing on top of a dirt berm, Paul, he said, Paul, this is 2%. This is all that's left.
Mm. I gather, though, that there is a battle with the government over the seawall. Is that still ongoing? And if so, what is the status of it?
You know, I think in a project that lasts decades, that billions have been invested with, it's been challenged in court. There have been media campaigns. There have been marches of people from Semongon all the way to the capital in Seoul to protest how this project has been developed. It's sort of done. I mean, the seawall's there. The damage is sort of done. Now the debate is, if there's a decision to kind of bring some of it back, can it be done? And is there the political will to kind of open up the sluice gates and let the sea back in after having spent billions of dollars keeping it out, right?
It sounds like, you know, a massive government infrastructure project that has gone kind of awry.
That's it. I mean, basically, human hubris, regardless of whether the original intention was good and wise, right? Growing food, that's a good thing, right? And economic development, that's a good thing. But just the massive energy and resources that put into this, what I got a sense of talking to local people and reading the literature about it is that it became this economic juggernaut that even when it wasn't working, just kind of kept on like zombie development.
Mm.
It's sunk investment, right? That's kind of the lesson I took away.
And you got a little, may I say, philosophical in your post about this, writing about mud and the nature of mud. Do you see it any differently now than you did before this walk?
Yeah, no, it's just walking through acres and acres of mud with the biologist, you know, driving past this kind of dead wetlands, getting mud on my hands, getting out kind of to visit with tourists who are trying to find the last clams that might still exist on the beach. I started thinking about what is mud after all, right? It's earth and it's water and it's motion, right? It requires motion. Mud can't just settle or it turns into kind of stone after a while. It requires tides, it requires movement. And I thought, that's who we are. That is what life is, that is what human beings are, that we are kind of have these qualities of mud within us. And so it was very sad to kind of put your hand into this mud and realize that there just wasn't much living in it anymore. There was no kind of living connection to it.
You can see photos and stories Paul has posted on his walk through South Korea. They're at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Thank you so much, Paul. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Carolyn. Until next time.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Sarah and Stephen Bass, Stephanie Fox and Drew Britcher, Deet and Paul Meserve, and Corey Zanin. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.